So now we can begin. So welcome to the Saturday afternoon meditation class. And apparently now it's all back to pretty much normal of our activities on a Saturday, Sunday, and also the Friday evening. But as well as that, we still have to wear our masks. For the time being anyway, so hopefully that's not too much of a burden for you. And normally that when you start meditating, the metabolism starts to calm down, you get more peaceful, you don't need to breathe so much, which means that it's not so disturbing wearing a mask when you are meditating. But in the meantime, that's because we still have our introduction to meditation class. It's a series of four lectures, which repeats itself again and again. Class 1, 2, 3, 4, and then again class 1, 2, 3, 4. For those people who haven't meditated before, and that class is being held in the building, which is just outside the main entrance, turn right. It's called the Community Hall. And that's where we're holding the Introduction to Meditation class by Pauline, very good teacher. So right here, this is for those who've meditated before. We do make that distinction because that here we like to meditate a little bit longer for 40, 45 minutes. And a 45 minute meditation is a bit too much when you too much when you're just beginning. So it's usually easier for people to meditate for the first time, short meditations, and more basic information about how to meditate. Here, because it's longer meditations, we usually focus on a different aspect every time. And what I wanted to focus on today was just how the meditation does bring up a greater sense of what we call in our modern world spirituality, where other things become a little bit more important than things like being right or being a high achiever or having lots of funds or the other things which people look for in life, like being admired by others or pleasing others. There's other things which we tend to incline towards when we do more meditation. Simply because you come to a place like this or go and retreat and you sit quietly for 45 minutes or an hour, again and again and again, and it feels so satisfying. Because it feels satisfying and it gives you a sense of contentment and fulfillment, maybe not sort of total fulfillment, but at least it's a beautiful experience. It makes you satisfied, and it means that you tend to incline more towards what people in this world call sort of spirituality. Even little things like trying to be always the one who wins, to be a winner. I've often made that little joke, I made that just a couple of weeks ago, that instead of being a winner, be a loser. Being a loser is much more fun. Because if you win something, then you will have to go into the next competition and strive again. And you keep on having to be challenged until finally someone is better than you and you get very disappointed. So it's much better to lose quickly and get all that stuff out of the way so you can relax and have a more peaceful life. And in fact, who wants to be a winner anyway? Of all the people in this planet Earth, billions of people, you only have one winner. And I still remember just one of my fellow monks. One of his best friends growing up at school, was a very good long-distance athlete. And he'd always win every time they were competing. He was always winning to the point that his teachers thought he was probably going to be an Olympic champion. He was really up at that up at that level. And then he'd win every race. And then one day, he was about 18, he lost his very first race. when he lost that race, my friend was, you know, I was told a story when my friend was a monk. He asked his friend, "What? How come you lost this time?" He said, "I finally figured out I didn't need to win." It was so much pain for him every time. He had to win. He must win. And he pushed his body so badly that he finally figured out he didn't need to do that anymore. He wasn't a winner anymore, but he was very peaceful and very content and very happy. It's like the spiritual life. We don't always need to win. We don't always need to be right, to actually to argue with other people, "I'm right and you're wrong." We find out that being right is also a problem. Because if you're right, then you become an expert. When you become an expert, then more and more people argue with you. If you become an expert on anything, then you're the person other people try to bring down because they think they know better than you. So it's nice not to be an expert. Even recently, I was just reminded a few minutes ago, I gave a meditation retreat at Jhana Grove to Thai people. Of course, there's a few other people came in on that retreat, and it was very successful for the Thais. They loved the deeper teachings on meditation, and they all said, "Oh, it's wonderful, it's fantastic." And I thought, "Oh my goodness, I'm in trouble now, because that means I would have to teach them another retreat. If I was smarter, I'd have given a terrible retreat, and then they would never have asked me again, so I could be free and have a nice, easy life." But of course, you always try your very best. But it's winning. Has lots and lots of problems with it. Being a loser, it means you're far more free. So those are little different attitudes which we have about how to have more peace and happiness. Why do you want to be famous? Why do you want to be the best? Why do you want to be any of those things? It's nice to be content, just to be who you are, at peace with yourself. You don't have to be the best. And as I said last night, other people, if they're wise, they can't measure you, because you don't measure yourself. You're beyond measure. And just imagine what that must be like, the spiritual ideal of not measuring yourself, not measuring your progress, not measuring time, not measuring how still you are. How would that be? If you don't measure anything, you can't do anything, you can't want anything. And also, you can't be upset with anything. You go to the spirituality of beyond measure. And that's the core behind that wonderful little piece of insight that all people, when you don't measure people, all people are loved equally. I don't mean that as a sort of theory, but as a reality. And sometimes, how can you love somebody who's angry, who doesn't look after you, who abuses you or whatever? How can you love people who hurt others? And I always just give the example of all the, not just the trees, but the bushes and the other plants in the forest. Some of the plants in the forest, you've got to be careful not to touch them because they will get, hand gets inflamed. Some are very spiky, so make sure you don't sort of get cut by them. But that's just their nature in the forest. And each one of those plants in the forest is important. Even the old trees in the forest. The old trees in the forest which are dead. And there's, because I've been at Serpentine Forest over 38 years now. There's one tree by the ablution block, Venerable, which when I first went there, other people said, "Cut it down." They called it the widow maker. The widow maker, they didn't really understand that monks don't have any wives, because they said that one day it's going to fall down. It's a big old Jarrah tree which was dead. When it falls down, it's going to kill somebody. And for 38 years, it hasn't fallen down at all. Still there, as it was 38 years ago. Jarrah's very tough. Even during our fires, a long time ago, almost 25, 30 years ago now, it survived okay. So little by little, all of the, even the old trees, the bent, the twisted trees, the bushes which may not look so nice, the things which are stinky and smelly or sharp. All of those things, you realize that they balance each other in the forest in ways which I cannot understand. In the same way that all the human beings in our planet may have people who are, sometimes they look nasty to you, but they teach you so much of how not to worry what other people say about you. The people who are violent, they teach you to run faster. You know, it's amazing to sometimes, I have been in these places where people can be violent to you, prisons. And people often ask me, weren't you ever afraid to go inside those jails? Because in those jails people had such long sentences that they could do anything to you and it wouldn't really matter to them. An extra couple of years on a 30-year sentence, they're probably going to die in jail anyway. So they had nothing to lose. And of course I had everything to lose. And people would rape visitors. And you should see some of these prisoners inside there. They were huge. They were monsters. They were gorillas. But I was always kind to them. I still remember this one guy. Oh, he was a good friend. He was a prisoner, by the way. I say that because he was a good friend. And he told me one day, he said, Ajahn Brahm, I know this, all this talk about people being raped. You know, men, visitors, as well as females, but most of the visitors were men. And all they being raped, and look, the prisoner told me, he said, you have nothing to worry about because I was respected in the jail. I've been kind to the people in the prison. And therefore there was no problem at all. I felt very, very safe. They said, if anybody tried that on you, there's half a dozen guys who would stop them. So you're safe. And that sort of started to tell me about so many of the fears we have in life, that they are not overcome with violence, not overcome with trying to hide in some safe spot, but just going out and being kind to people. And other people seem to not be able to harm you. I'll just finish off on this little tangent about reading this little article which somebody sent to me. I think it's from the New York Times or something. And this was like a Hindu sage, some Hindu guru, who was just walking home from giving a talk someplace to where he was staying. And, you know, he's a real proper Indian guru. No shoes, simple clothing, and just walking back in the evening. And a couple of young hoodlums stopped him. Give me your wallet, Mac! Or something like that. Maybe I don't know the right speech. Give me your wallet, punk. Is that right? I don't know. I haven't watched movies for years. Give me your wallet, punk. But the Hindu sage said, you know, I don't have a wallet. I don't have money. Don't give me that. Give me your wallet. And they took out a knife or something. And he didn't pull out another knife and say, you call that a knife? This is a knife. Somebody showed me that little clip from, was it Crocodile Dundee, is that right? Yeah. He said, I just don't have any money. I'm a Hindu sage. I'm peaceful. And apparently they said, no, we don't believe you. He said, no, you can check me if you like. And he was so unafraid and kind that the two boys who tried to rob him started talking with him about religion. And they had a conversation about Hinduism, meditation, peace, non-violence. And afterwards, you know, after a 5 or 10 minute conversation, they put their knives away and said, I'm sorry, sir, we bothered you. Have a nice trip back. And of course, he was a bit late getting back, and so that was told to some of his friends, and that got into the New York Times. And just a lovely example of a person who probably should have been robbed in most situations, but because he was kind and peaceful, that they left him alone. And I've experienced things like that as well, that sometimes in our life, spirituality just comes not as a theory, but comes from within, simply because we have lots of peaceful moments where you can see yourself, you can see others, and not judge anybody. So whoever you meet in life, you can be kind to them, as if they're your best friend, like a son or a daughter you meet, like a mother. You treat everybody with such kindness and openness. And it's not something you can plan or make happen, it's just something which does happen, simply because you touch those beautiful places in your heart when you meditate, when you're peaceful, you recognize them. And they actually come up to be your part of your character. It's one of the reasons why that people, happens on all the retreats which I give, there's always one or two people. So my wife sent me, I didn't really want to come, because my wife wants me to be a bit more peaceful and a bit more kind and less stressed. Or the kids tell the mum, you have to go to meditation. Why? Because you're a much nicer mummy when you come back from meditation. And these are like honesty. People see how meditation changes your attitude towards life. It makes you a far more spiritual, peaceful, wonderful human being. So it's not just getting the very deep, peaceful states, which are wonderful, great, amazing insights, but it's insights which are not just changing your theories of life, it changes the way you look at life. Changes the way you interact with other people. Changes the way you interact with someone like COVID, with life and death, with everything. You're far more peaceful, far more calm, a much more beautiful human being. So that's what happens. That's the insight which happens in meditation. The insight into learning how to be at peace and kind. So there we go, that's just a little bit of an intro. So now we can actually do the meditation. So, as usual, I should say again, because a few people came in, that this is the ongoing class on meditation for those who come to the introductory class. That is being held in the building, which is to the north of here, only about 50 meters. That's the introduction to class. Okay. So, closing the eyes. And bringing awareness to your posture, how you're sitting. I usually give the same guidance almost every time, because it's what I do. I've just honed it down over many years. It works. If you don't want to listen to my guidance, you can always get some earbuds and put them in your ear holes to turn it off. It's much better. So we bring our attention, first of all, to our body. And to establish mindfulness on our body, we can't just turn a switch on and have that mindfulness right there. It grows. It gets established. It takes some time. But it's important, because I know not only does it give me physical comfort, but it means my body is not going to disturb me for the whole period of the meditation. Because I can go very deep inside. And that's so pleasurable and so beautiful. So I first of all ask my legs how they are. It's a little technique which I've developed. I ask parts of my body. Just like a doctor might ask you how are your ears today, or how's that injury on your arm. When you ask that question, your mindfulness goes to that area of the body. So get information of how comfortable your legs are, whether they're in a good position or not. My legs are not in a good position, so I'm going to move them. better. And I notice when you move your legs, they're in a more comfortable position. And that shows me that the mindfulness with the kindness actually creates comfort and ease, which allows things to settle down. And then I make sure my feet, my ankles, calves, knees and thighs are all in a comfortable position. I just check all parts of it. When everything is comfortable, then I can move on and move to my butt. Making sure that's at ease. There have been times when I just skipped that too fast. And during the meditation, my bottom is just really sore. If I don't move, it disturbs the meditation. It's such a shame. So these days I'm always very aware of this part of the meditation, of how my bottom muscles feel. Making sure they're all comfortable on top of the cushion. And I move if necessary. That's better. And then go up to my back, stretching my back. Gives a beautiful sense of joy, pleasure in my back muscles when I stretch. And then I let go. When I let go after stretching, just let the back go into a nice comfortable posture. The back feels good. No aches or pains anyway. And maybe go to the front of my torso, where I can feel some of the organs in my body. Starting just with the colon and intestines, just checking them all, making sure they're all at ease. I can feel my body. Sometimes I don't know the name of what I'm feeling, what I'm experiencing. But I know if it's comfortable, if it's relaxed. When I come to a part of my body which is tense or seems to be a bit tight, I just zoom in on it. Just like on Google Maps, you zoom into a location. And then I give it kindness. The kindness just makes everything feel so much more relaxed and at ease. Sometimes it allows energy to go to that part of the body. And it happens, parts of that body just warm up. So if they're taking some healing energy, placing in that spot, and things are getting more peaceful. Go right up my body, to my lungs, chest, and after a practice you can relax any part of your body. the whole body feels so at ease. Let go to the shoulders. Relax them. These muscles on the shoulders, I feel them sometimes like they're being pulled apart. And I look at them like that. And I learn how to let go of both ends of those muscles. So the shoulder muscles is happening now to my shoulder muscles. They're getting nice and loose and at ease. You have much power over your body. You can lift an arm, you can move a leg. Why can't you relax shoulder muscles? Of course you can, you learn how to do that. They become nice and loose and at ease all by themselves. And I go down my arms, elbows, forearms. Everything seems to be okay there. To my hands. The hands again, there's always lots of feelings, sensations in the hands. So many nerve endings there. It's a very sensitive part of a person's body. And then I make sure, I ask my hands, are you comfortable like you are? Or would you like to be moved? Do you need adjusting? Today my hands say yes, they do. So I move them around. That feels much better. When my hands are comfortable, then I move my attention back to my shoulders and my neck. Got a little bit of irritation, minor hay fever or something today. And I just focus on my throat. I can feel a tightness there. So I loosen that tightness, relax everything. However long it takes. And go up to the face, making sure that the muscles around the eyes and the mouth are at ease. I feel them and relax them. Simple as that. That also calms down many emotions. And it feels pleasant. Everything is loose and at ease. And I feel that my face is relaxed to the max. And I just observe the whole body sitting here. Not in parts, but as a whole, united. All at peace, relaxed, at ease. My back needed a bit of adjustment, so I did that. The whole purpose is to develop strong awareness. You can really feel your body. And the kindness, this wonderful compassion, which is willing to ask your body what it needs to make it more comfortable. If movement doesn't work, kindness does. Just wishing it well. Like a mother gives kindness to a child, and the child relaxes and feels safe and at peace, and often your child will go to sleep. So I'm just being with the whole body, relaxing it as deep as I possibly can. And as usual, it's happening now for me. You get a delightful feeling in the body. The delight of relaxation. You may not be totally relaxed, but you're much more relaxed than when you started. I feel so joyful. So at ease. And it's deliberately noticing that joy allows me to stay with my body with no effort, and the relaxation gets stronger and deeper. And after a while you know it's the time to go away from your body, go inside to the mind. The peaceometer. How peaceful am I right now? And how can I create deeper peace? Or rather, how can I let that peace deepen? Already the peace is delightful enough that I like watching it. I don't need to force my mind. It's like seeing a good old friend and you just stick with them through no force. You don't force your attention on peace. It's peace which holds your attention to it. Feels good. And all the past vanishes. All the future just evaporates. Because peace exists now. It's such a beautiful, a delightful experience. It holds your attention in the present moment. It also holds you in silence. As the mind calms down. And the mindfulness, the perception in this present moment gets stronger and stronger and more joyful. and the mind is really peaceful. It's not that hard to be able to be aware of your breath. Just breathing in, breathing out. And if you were peaceful enough, and mindfulness was strong enough, the perception of the breath stays with you. Because it's, again, delightful. Such a simple thing to watch. I often say, like watching the waves on the beach, a quiet part of the ocean, on a very still, windless day. And those waves just go slowly up the sand, reach their peak, and just fall away. Totally beyond your control. But regular, reassuring, safe, and peaceful. Just watching the simplicity of breath coming in and going out. But don't force your attention on these things. See the joy in it, the delight, the pleasure. And that will keep your attention fixed. I'm going to be quiet now until close to the end of the meditation.
getting close to the end of the meditation. How do you feel inside? How much peace is there? And how clear and agile is your mindfulness? Are you enjoying the peace inside? If you are, then the mind doesn't wander. Doesn't need to. Doesn't want to. Start to emerge from inside. Feel your body again, sitting here perfectly still. See how comfortable you feel when you go inside. Sometimes how healthy the body is after you've been still. Now that delightful feeling is there, the body relaxed to the max by inner peace. I'm now going to ring the gong 3 times to end today's meditation. Excellent. Okay, now we do have some questions from overseas. Is there any questions from our audience here first? You have one? Oh, good. Question over there. I saw one over here first of all. Gentleman in red. What is, have you got a...
I've been reading about Eckhart Tolle.
Yes.
Who I think is a patron of many millions of people. And I suppose the thrust of his books are really to be in the presence, not thinking about the past.
Yes.
And one of the things that he looks at is observing the mind.
Here we go, yes.
Is observing your mind. I was just wondering whether you have any comments about that, observing your mind, and if you'd like looking at the thoughts that you've always got in your mind, and you go into that observing.
Yeah. He's talking about, this is for describing Eckhart Tolle's developing the present moment awareness and looking at the mind, but then what does look at the mind? And the idea of awareness is that process by which you can sort of know what you're thinking. But if you look even closer, you don't know what you're thinking, you know what you were thinking a moment ago. If you're thinking, you're thinking. If you're knowing, it's a different part of the mind working. So you know you are thinking. And the thinking itself is quite disturbing. You don't need to give things names. The example of that, which I often give but haven't given for quite a few weeks, was the little story of Lao Tzu, Taoist master, who would go on a walk with one disciple every evening. But when they went on a walk, they had to keep silence, weren't allowed to say anything. And one day, a new disciple went on a walk with a master, and they came to a ridge in the mountains at sunset, and it was such a gorgeous, beautiful sunset. The young student on the first walk forgot the rule, and he blurted out, "What a beautiful sunset that is, look at that, that's gorgeous." And the master turned around and went home. And then he said, when he got back into his monastery, he said, "That young man can never go on a walk with me ever again. He broke the rule." And when some of his friends said, "You're being too tough, too strict. It's only saying, what a beautiful sunset, what's wrong with that?" And this is where the beautiful line comes in, the teaching comes in. Because Lao Tzu said, "When my student said, what a beautiful sunset," when he said those words, he wasn't watching the sunset anymore. He was watching the words. Not the sunset, but the words, the description. And the thoughts are like that. If you're aware of your thoughts, the thoughts aren't deep enough. You weren't watching a description of what's happening, or what's actually happening. So after a while, the thoughts get settled down. There are no thoughts. So it's just the experience of now, and it gets much more peaceful, more beautiful. And then the mindfulness gets stronger. Something which I was talking about last night, the awareness of the present moment. Even a drunk is aware of the present moment, but not very strongly. But then as we meditate more and more, our awareness goes more powerful. We see more of what's here. We go beyond the thinking, go much more to a knowing. We know what's happening. It's very peaceful and very still. So that's where we go, into a deeper awareness. And the other little thing which I've often focused on and pointed out, as the mind does become more still, more silent, the awareness gets stronger, you also get more joy. It's just a form of happiness. I've called it delight, for want of a better word. Just delight in being still. The beauty of peace, the rapture of silence. It's a very delightful place to be. And so, that is a sign your mindfulness is getting very strong. When it gets very strong and you're enjoying yourself immensely, that's why you can meditate for a long time. There's no effort at all, you're just having a wonderful time. And of course, no feelings in the body, because you're in the mind, going deeper inside. So your body can be old, you can be ill, you can be sick, you don't even feel it, because you've got the beauty and the bliss inside. I think that adds much more to your question than you asked, but why not? Are you satisfied with that for now? Is there anything else? Okay, so we get the questions from overseas. Because, you know, this is live streamed. Oh, it's got water on it. Ah, there we go. To unlock. Yeah, very good. So first of all, from Josephine, "Dear Ajahn, how does emptiness, openness and transcending," that's about last night's talk, "differ from going out of one's mind, losing it?" Because you're never out of your mind.
when you have strong mindfulness and openness and transcending, you just go deep inside. Nothing's outside of anything. You're deeply inside what's happening. And as you go deep inside, it's not me somewhere else. Very still, very peaceful. Your body is just basically not there. And your mind is very peaceful and still. Some are going out of their mind. It's almost like they're crazy, they're mad. This is, you've never been more sane in your whole life. You're peaceful, you're kind, you're loving, you're joyful. And one way you can know that is that after the meditation is completed, when it's finished, then the state of your mind afterwards, as I said earlier, is like spiritual, it's kind, it's peaceful. No one can really make you angry, and you've got such a huge resource of being kind to others. And how can one survive being friendly and open-hearted all the time? People might hurt you bad. Try it, they don't hurt you bad. If you've got so much kindness inside of you, they can't hurt you. It's one of those little stories which I mentioned on the Thai retreat, I think it was, that of, now, whoever you are, even if you're a Buddha, people always, you know, would want to, maybe some people to harm you, but you become unharmable. So somebody set this assassin, a trained assassin, to kill the Buddha. It's a pretty easy task. He didn't have any arms or any guards. He's just sitting quietly in the forest somewhere. So they hired an assassin to kill the Buddha, and then two assassins to kill that one assassin. And then four assassins to kill the two assassins, eight to kill the four, and 16 to kill the eight. That way there would be no trace. Such was the theory. But what happened? The first assassin, a trained assassin just with a sharp knife, so found the Buddha. Oh, you can't kill the Buddha. He's just too sweet and too nice and too lovable and so, oh. Have you ever come across people like that, or little animals, or what is it called, little seals, baby seals or something? They're so cute and so wonderful that you just can't harm them. And living in Bodhinyana Monastery, there's such a lot of wildlife there. No way you can harm any of those little animals. They're too nice. But anyway, can you get this back again for me? Anyway, those assassins, they just couldn't hurt the Buddha at all. And the Buddha knew what was going on. He told the one assassin to go that way because it's trying to kill you. And the two found the Buddha and said, have you seen these two assassins? And the Buddha sort of told them, oh, just come on, be kind. So anyway, no one got killed in the end. But you find that when you do have a lot of kindness inside of you, a lot of purity, a lot of softness inside of you, as you said here, very open, people can't harm you. They just can't do it. They maybe want to, but, oh. If you've come across people like that, you understand what I'm talking about. From Czechoslovakia, from Tom, what is the best way to practice non-self? The mind feels that taking things as mind beings troubled, but the bonds seem too solid. It's saying it's not me trying to control. It's not me saying, it's just seeing what is obvious. Not trying to control, just remind you. But one of the best ways of doing that, and that's a little story which many of you know, but it's a good story. I'm here for the whole weekend. Friday afternoon, come here, and Saturday and Sunday, we are having a little executive committee meeting from 5 to 7 and 7:15, giving a talk about Buddhist nuns over to UK on Zoom. And you work very hard on the weekend. And then on Sunday evening you go back to Bodhinyana Monastery, and Monday you do the work at Bodhinyana Monastery. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, 7 days a week job. But what told me off one day was I was just walking on Monday morning through Bodhinyana Monastery. I'm the boss there, I'm the abbot. And so somebody was, I was walking with us, oh, you're so lucky to live in this beautiful monastery. It's so perfect and peaceful and I said, what are you talking about? This is not peaceful. There's so much work to be done here. I've got to make sure the paths are swept, the gutters are clean, there's rain coming, and some of the monks are not behaving properly. I've got to tell them off. I've got to do this, and I've got to make sure that this is happening and that is happening for the council and for somebody else. And then I realized that the visitor was enjoying the place where I live, but I wasn't. That was really unfair. I spent so much time and energy and effort building up Bodhinyana Monastery, and other people can enjoy it, not me. Because it was mine. And then I decided, Monday mornings, I'm not the abbot, I'm not the boss, I'm not the teacher. If somebody has a question about meditation, sorry, not me, I'm not the abbot today. If there's a leak in the water pipes, sorry, not me. Because that day I'm a visitor. So I just pretend to be a visitor in the place where I live, not an owner. So I don't have any responsibilities. If the monks are going crazy and killing each other, not my problem. If somebody's robbing the donation box, it's not my problem. I'm only visiting today. Then I can see that monastery in a totally different way, like you can. Like you come in here and see this hall, it's nice and peaceful, beautiful. If you're the caretakers, well, it needs to be swept, it needs to be cleaned, or those windows are open, they should have been closed. So you can see the difference between an owner and a visitor. That's a wonderful way of practicing non-self. Maybe a couple of hours or a morning a week in the home in which you live. Be a visitor, not an owner. As if you were visiting somebody else's home. You don't, when you go to dinner at somebody else's home, you don't wash the dishes for them. That's their job. You don't cook, you don't clean the shelves. It's not your job. So you can enjoy somebody else's house. You can enjoy your own body when you're only visiting. You can enjoy your own mind. It's not your mind, you're just visiting for 45 minutes in meditation. Take no responsibility. Mind is crazy, it's nothing to do with me. Mind is peaceful, it's not me. When you're a visitor, not an owner. It's a wonderful way of starting the practice of non-self. Just visiting Dhammaloka Center. Who owns this place? Does anyone own this place? Not me, I only come for the weekends. Dennis, you've been president of this society for such a long time. Do you own this? No. You just enjoy it. No responsibility. And that you feel much more freedom, you see much more beauty. It's a good way of practicing non-self, non-ownership. And even when you're sick, your body belongs to nature, not to you. So let nature just look after it. Next question from Scotland. Ever since experience the powerful nimitta, that's a beautiful light which comes up in the mind, I'm afraid of going that deep again in meditation. Oh, come on. At the same time, I want to experience it again, but I can't. How can I overturn this block? First of all, wanting to experience it. The reason why these beautiful states of mind come to you is because they surprise you. You didn't expect it. You didn't want it. It was just got very peaceful, and there it was. Wow. And now you see that, and it's so gorgeous, you want it back. Please, it doesn't belong to you. You create all the conditions. In other words, you'd be really peaceful. You don't want anything in the whole world. So content, just being here, just say with a delightful breath, breathing in, breathing out. Who wants anything more than that? So happy, so at ease. And then these things are likely to come. And one of the reasons why they were scared, you were scared, sorry, was it was totally out of control, beyond your control. You can't control these things. You just let them happen. It's one of the reasons why it's when your sense of self just vanishes, you're not there anymore. You're not in control. Like your hands are taken off the steering wheel of your car, feet off the pedals. It looks after itself. The last little anecdote Just that story of, when I used to go traveling, what do you do on the aircraft? And sometimes you meditate, sometimes you try and sleep or whatever, but I looked at one of these in-flight magazines, and it was the Air Asia in-flight magazine, and there was an article by a pilot. It's really well worth reading, because he was trying to describe his ideas of the aircraft in the future. And he said the aircraft in the future, there'll only be two beings in the cockpit. Only two beings. It'll be the pilot and the dog. That's all in the cockpit, a pilot and his dog. And the job of the dog, the job of the pilot, the only job of the pilot is to feed the dog. Make sure the dog is well fed. That's the only job the pilot has. And the job of the dog is to bite the pilot if he touches anything. It's totally automatic. But people want to have somebody up there, makes them feel safe. And so that's how we meditate. A little dog inside, if you do anything, get bitten. So you just allow these nimittas just to come. If you try and do anything, you get bit. Then they'll come very wonderfully. From India, taking promotion in bank profession gives me stress. Without promotion, I am at peace. But without promotion, I have a shortage of money for family. Please advise. Yeah, Champram. Whenever you have a family, it's a sacrifice, obviously. You just can't do what you want. It has to be what we want. So, see if you can. What we do is, if you take a promotion in the bank profession, make sure that you have opportunities to meditate. 5 minutes even, where you sit at the desk, you close your eyes, and make your mind very peaceful, realizing that your job is only a visitor to the bank. You don't own the bank, you're working for it. But spend some time just sitting in your desk, just being peaceful, like you're at home or like you're in a monastery somewhere. When you bring peace for 5 minutes during the middle of the day, you're resting, you don't get so stressed out. Here we go again. I think I said this last night or somewhere recently. How heavy is my glass of water? The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. If I keep holding it, even though I'm tired, I get very stressed. When this gets heavy, too uncomfortable to hold, I will put it down. When I've rested, I'll pick it up again. That way I can carry this for much longer and never feel in pain or never stressed. The cause of stress is not the amount of work you have. It's nothing to do with the amount of responsibilities you have. Stress is you don't put it down when you need to have a rest. From Dorota in Netherlands, what is the difference between letting things go and apathy, depression, and laziness? When you really let things go, you get a boost of energy. You're really very high, have huge energies. When you have apathy, depression, and laziness, you've got no energy at all. So letting go creates energy. Other things just saps energy, you don't have any energy. So you sit here, you let things go, or much better to say, let things be. When you let things be, you just are. You get deep stillness, a lot of rest, powerful mindfulness, huge energies, and afterwards it's amazing what you can produce. I said a few people recently that first book which I wrote, The Opening the Door of Your Heart, is amazing. It's still a bestseller. Another 20 years, I think. Coming up to 15 or between 15 and 20 years. And it was so easy to write. 1 hour for 15 days, and that was more than the first half of the book. It's not much, because I was on a retreat, meditation, my own retreat, and I decided 1 hour every day I'll just write some stories down on a piece of paper, just with a biro pen. And the amazing thing was that the writing was perfect, no mistakes. I still got the manuscript, it's in my room. Every now and again I'd take that back, wow, How did that happen? And somebody just typed it up for me. And when I took it to, I was giving some talks in Melbourne. So they gave it to me just before I left the airport. And I got the first talk, was a talk at Melbourne Uni. And that was just straight off the aircraft to Melbourne University, giving a talk. And after the talk, this girl, Magnolia Flora, beautiful name, she said, "Oh, it was a wonderful talk, Ajahn Brahm. I work in the publishing industry. If you ever have something to publish, please let me know." Gave it to her straight away, straight out of my bag into her hand. She was stunned. And that's how it started, so easy sometimes. So when you let things be, things flow so easily and they're easy to do. Didn't take me any time at all to write that book. And lastly, from South Korea, would explain about a Pali word, sangwega, urgency, in English, relating samadhi and insight practices, essentially helpful in Buddhist practice. Oh, from South Korea, yes, not North Korea. Sangwega, urgency, it just makes it the fact that, what am I messing around for? Why am I just doing all this rubbish stuff when you're meditating? Why do I have to think about this or think about that? I say, oh, come on, put that aside. And it's not a stress for urgency. It's not like someone saying, faster, faster, do this. It's always something which helps you focus on what's really important and lets you abandon what's not important. So it's more just feeling sort of not interested in all these other things when you're supposed to be meditating. You're not trying to write your autobiography or figure out the problems you have in your life. Because you figure out one problem, you find another problem. There's no shortage of life problems. But there's a shortage of peace and stillness. So put the urgency on creating peace and stillness. And then all those other problems, the answers come themselves. There we go. That was the questions. Again, a bit longer than usual. Usually finish at 4:15, it's now 4:25, but any other questions which people have from the floor? Okay, we'll finish off now because you've got no questions, and then we'll have people asking the questions in front of me. Okay, so now we can just bow three times.